This Week in Retronauts, if you don't subscribe, we'll smash your windows. Everyone, welcome to another episode of Retronauts. This is the most threatening episode of all, and that is because we are talking about a game based on the subscription model, not the games as a service model, but rather the subscription model where you pay a dollar and the paper boy will deliver papers for you for a week. And with me here to talk about this ancient video game, we have such cool dudes as...
Ben Elgin?
Chris Sims in an isometric view.
Nope, that's not correct.
No, it's
what
not.
Is it? What
it's
is it?
Oblique.
Oh,
I looked it up this
oblique
time.
Projection. This time we finally got it right.
We got it right. Yes.
You might be isometric, but then you're skewed and out of proportion with everyone else.
Listen, I did my best for having prepared zero things for this show.
Okay, fair enough.
And Ben Jacobs, who is oblique and obtuse.
All right. Well, I'm glad we could. We could confirm that. So hi, this is a little bit of a different episode. We've done something kind of like this before, but this is not a full episode of us talking about a video game. What's going to happen is for about 15 minutes-ish, we're going to talk about the game in question, Paperboy, and then we're going to jump over to a developer interview with the guy who created Paperboy. And that's really cool. I didn't write his name down. God dang it. It's been like a couple of months since I interviewed this guy. Wow.
Splice it Walter in post. Larson.
We're going to edit it in later. Walter Larson. We have an interview with Walter Larson.
Yeah. So anyway, we're talking to that guy. We're talking to
John Sawitz.
John Sawitz.
Yeah. Okay. So
someone who worked at Atari in Eastridge, because that's where this was made.
Right? Yeah. Oh, what is wrong with me? Anyway, you'll learn a lot about him directly in his own words in about 15 minutes. So just stick with us through this. Wow. It's been a really hectic month. I don't know what to tell you. Anyway, so we're going to talk about the game and set up the context for it. And then we'll switch over to the interview segment where a person who is very important and knows a lot about the game from a firsthand experience can tell you all about it. So that's cool. We're talking about Paperboy. So, guys, what experience do you have with Paperboy, the video game or the job?
My dad was a paperboy.
Was that when he was a boy or a man?
He was a boy. Oak Ridge, Tennessee in the 1950s, probably.
Okay.
Was he one of the Oak Ridge boys? No.
Oh.
This is before, well, I don't know how associated with country music that place was at the time. It was a bunch of nuclear physicists getting together, developing an atomic bomb and stuff. So it wasn't.
And then
really
country
music
came along and they were like, my God, what have I become?
We have become.
Yeah, death.
Destroyer
of the radio.
Okay.
My father was actually.
How dare you? The Oak Ridge Boys are a delight.
I didn't say they're not, but they are also unto the Grim Reaper. Yeah, my father was also a paper boy, but not when he was a boy. He was a paper man who. I just remember when I was like. In elementary school, he very briefly would do the paperboy thing, but not really because he would drive, you know, down the street in his car and toss papers because technology had advanced by that point.
Did he break anyone's windows?
Not that he told us about. I don't remember any subpoenas or anything, so I think we were okay.
Because I don't know, this is really like you know, like the way that you introed the podcast. Like this one thing about this game is it's really kind of this like late capitalist hellscape, right? Where, you know, if you don't subscribe, then open season.
It's interesting because we live in a late capitalist hellscape, and yet newspaper subscriptions are not a thing anymore.
Yeah, it didn't really happen that way.
Yeah,
it's sort of transplanted.
It's a fantasy.
These days, he would just be like lobbing awful
bullets.
Tweets through
right.
people's
computers. So should we, like, for anyone who hasn't actually played this game and doesn't know what we're talking
about?
Yeah, so
you're for sure.
To...
You guys haven't told me what your experience with being a paperboy or playing paperboy is yet.
I actually really like the game. I'm terrible at it.
Yeah.
But I, you know, obviously rented it when I was a kid, played it in arcades when I was a kid. Could never, I think I made it to legitimately to level two. And that was it.
I've made it to level three once. Yeah. It's a hard game.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know that I ever actually played this in arcades. I don't think I ever played it with the special arcade controller. This had like this bike handlebar controller, evidently.
Oh, I never saw that.
Yeah, this is fascinating. I read it was actually a modified Star Wars yoke. So they took old Star Wars yokes and like transformed them into bike
just
handlebars.
Just the yokes? What about the whites?
I can see it because you're like Star Wars, you're trying to launch a torpedo down the Death Star shaft. Here you're trying to toss papers into someone's mailbox.
These bullseye mailboxes.
And your T-16 back home?
Yeah.
They're Beggar's Canyon?
They're not even as big as 2 meters.
Oh my gosh. All right. Well, I've played this in the arcade.
This is the deep info that we're looking for. Come on.
Also, I read some incredible trivia about this game.
Was it on vintagecomputing.com?
But I forgot it.
Oh.
There's something really cool about who developed this game and why. But
everyone just had coffee and I put a little alcohol in his and you can see the effects already.
Yeah, some of us only have alcohol, but
I will say it reminds me of 720 because it's the similar vintage in terms of like, I think it may have used the same system board, similar resolution graphics and color depth and stuff like that. And
it used the Atari system too. It was actually the first game put out on it.
Okay, well, this is 720 on the system too?
I think it was a later one on the same one, maybe.
Yeah, because I remember seeing Paperboy sort of everywhere around that time in the mid 80s. This machine was actually kind of common. I mean, it was like,
yeah, it was a hugely popular game.
Yeah,
it's really interesting because it's a concept that you wouldn't really think would be a great video game. It is a game in which you play as a paperboy, and there are no like space battles. There are no dungeon monsters. Like literally, you are just a kid riding your bike down a street and delivering papers to your subscribers' homes, and if you want some bonus points, you can chuck newspapers into your non-subscribers' windows. It's a very passive, not even passive aggressive. It's just aggressive. It's just plain old aggressive.
How hard do you have to throw a newspaper?
I mean, they're rolled up. You know, people have been killed. Like Flanders' wife, you know, she was killed by a t-shirt cannon. So I feel like this is just the same thing.
That's some deep.
I'm sorry for bringing up the memory of Maud Flanders.
Too soon. I'm genuinely surprised that there's not like a, and maybe there is, but like a modern mobile game version of Paperboy. Seems like it would be the easiest sell because like all the upgrades are obvious.
Yeah, I feel like there have been some remakes.
No one knows what a Paperboy is now.
Yeah.
Newspapers don't exist.
Actually, I overtalked Chris's joke earlier. Was the modern equivalent was throwing tweets at people. Mm. That's what Chris said, but I said,
I feel like they should remake this for
they could do that.
VR systems now. Do like an Oculus or PSVR version where you're just chucking, you know, using motion control.
That would actually be kind of fun.
I think it could work.
Into it.
I feel like one of the reasons for its popularity and the thing that we don't have anymore is that Paperboy was such a ubiquitous pop culture thing, even if it wasn't a like real life thing anymore.
Like, yeah, it's like, you know, in the 1920s you had newsboys standing there saying, "Get your extra paper now!" And in the 1960s you had those people, you know, decentralized away from cities into the suburbs riding bikes.
Yeah. And I once read a really interesting article on the sort of obsession that my generation and the generation immediately before, like Gen X and millennials, had with older television, and how because of cable and because of syndication and the expansion of television as this, you know, common thing, we all sort of got this cultural background of older TV shows. Like, everyone I know grew up with Brady Bunch. Everyone I know grew up with, like, you know,
Gilligan's Island. MASH, Star Trek.
Dennis the Menace. Yeah, and, like, every kid on all of those old sitcoms that, like, I was obsessed with. And I would stay up all night watching Nick at Night because I was a weird child. You know, all the kids would have paperboy jobs. So it was part of the cultural landscape, even though it wasn't really around anymore, or at least it doesn't seem like it was around. I never had a paper boy. I always had a paper man with a car.
Right.
Yeah. But, and on top, and what comes with that is you've also got this like very familiar landscape. So whereas most games are, you know, some fantastic setting or sci-fi or whatever, or just weird. this was the suburbs.
Yeah.
This was, you know, you had your, you were avoiding your suburban obstacles of cars and dogs, which is what you really had to avoid if you went out on your bike. So all the people who were, you know, going to the Blockbuster and renting video games were these, you know, young white kids who lived in exactly these places. And so it's like kind of, it's navigating your own neighborhood in a game.
Yeah. Speaking of that setting, if you go to the Wikipedia page, I was struck, which I did not do. The person who told me this was struck by the fact that the first picture says that this is set in the United States of America. Like, that's the caption of the image of the thing, which is something that's, it's familiar to us, that. The suburban, you know, landscape. But, you know, if you're from out of the country in the English speaking world, this might not be.
Yeah, well, this was developed at Atari Games. It was one of the earliest games that they produced after splitting away from Atari Corp. And so, yeah, they were very much about that sort of suburban Americana, although they were based in, you know, the Bay Area of California. Yeah. So I think, you know, even to them, it was kind of a little bit of a, like, the suburban fantasy was a little bit removed because, yeah, you know, as California developed in the latter half of the 20th century, it took on a different texture and quality than, like, you know, a neighborhood in Illinois or South Carolina or something.
But yeah, it was. I mean, it was a distinctly American setting, which was not that common in video games at the time. And I actually read so this comes with a like Wikipedia citation needed on it. But so this was put out on NES by Tengen, and apparently it was one of the first NES carts put out of a game developed in the U.S.
Yeah, it was somewhere there.
It's completely true, but it's definitely, you know.
So it has this. It has this very familiar setting of, you know, houses, dogs, streets.
Angry people.
But then there's a weird wish fulfillment aspect to it where, like, you can just chuck something through your neighbor's window. Yeah.
And the downside is that bees will chase you and sometimes you run into the Grim Reaper.
And at the end of the level, you're on the front page of the newspaper, the paper boy, which is a gross violation of journalistic ethics.
Well, you're on there for being a hero. You're
unless,
like,
it's a rival paper. In which case you're so good at being a paper boy, the other
this was the tail end of multi-newspaper cities. I mean, when I was growing up, there was the morning paper and the evening paper in Lubbock, Texas, and I would go up to visit family in Flint, Michigan, and they would have like the Flint Journal and some other, like, Flint Times or something. Dispatch. Yeah, exactly. There were multiple newspapers, and that was going away in the 80s. So this was kind of created at the tail end of the relevance of the newspaper as a primary vehicle for news and information.
I agree. In fact, as early as the early 80s, I've talked to journalists from back then who knew that everything was going to eventually go the way of computer networks and stuff, even way back then, but they couldn't convince people with the money to steer things in that direction. And of course, even if they did, it would eventually get obliterated by competition of too much media anyway.
Yeah.
It would be so nice if just someone would come and give me the news once a day instead of it being a constant fire hose into my brain.
Don't you miss those days? I blame CNN and O.J. Simpson. So, you know, Ben, what you mentioned earlier about this being that there not having been a lot of games set in America. That was you who said that, right? To that point. That's true. Like, you know, you play so many games in the 8-bit era that came from Japan, and they're set in, like, you know, the neighborhoods of Tokyo or something. Like, they have this urban setting, anything from River City Ransom to Chubby Cherub. Like, it was just really common to see games come from overseas set in, you know, just normal environments. But in American-made games, if they tended to show American environments, it tended to be like big cities like downtown Manhattan or Chicago or something. You didn't see the suburbs that often. There was not really that element of familiarity. That's probably why Home Alone was so successful too. Like, that game sucked, but it was like, wow, I'm running around, you know, shooting dudes with a slingshot in a house. This is cool. Yeah. I'm finding pizza in the toilet. I love it. Yeah. So there was definitely that appeal to it. And like I said, this was you know, one of the first games created by Atari Games after their split from Atari Corp. And the company just really fostered creativity in that era. Like, if you look at the games they created, you know, 720, Marble Madness, Rampart, Paperboy, like, all of them had different themes, different concepts, and all of them were, they were really compelling in some way. They were just different from the sort of sci-fi, action, violent fantasy games you saw.
Yeah, they're all iconic, and they each had their own conceit. What is the right word I'm thinking of? Like a distinctive
hook,
and visual style,
aesthetic
yeah. that was distinctive, but mm-hmm. but simple and obvious to grasp easily and quickly.
Mm-hmm.
There's a word for that.
They spoke to you.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, that was a golden age for Atari games. Their early years after the split up of mm-hmm. Atari.
But yeah, it's a fun and pretty simple game, but again, really challenging. And it showed up on every platformer under the sun. The NES game was incredibly successful. There were sequels that didn't really do much. Paperboy 2 was like...
I think I played it on Apple.
The mm-hmm. same thing, but you could play as a girl if you wanted to, and it didn't have any impact on the game. Oh. You were just Paper Girl.
I just thought of something. The protagonist is a kid, and you're a kid. You know, that's what was cool about it. I just remembered that when I was a kid, I wanted to play Paperboy because, look, you're a kid. It's like an empowerment thing.
Like the Goonies 2.
Yeah, just like the Goonies 2. But, yeah, that's fascinating. Now, there's a Sega Master System version of this game. It's not too bad, I think. I played that.
It was
recently.
On everything at the time. Like, you know, CPC and Spectrum.
I played all those.
It was on everything. And they usually captured it pretty effectively. I think the Game Boy version suffered because you already have a limited viewpoint because of the oblique projection. You're mm-hmm. like in a tiny corner of the screen, but you take away, you know, 2/3 of the screen real estate's pixel space. It's a hard game.
Sounds tough.
Hmm. Anyway, I think that's it. So unless you guys have something more to say, why don't we jump over to the interview section?
I got one thing.
Okay, you got one thing.
I have a question for the guy you're going to interview. Can you pass it on to him?
Go ahead.
I say this knowing that it's a bad idea, but I do kind of want like one of those weird Bionic Commando style remakes, but of Paperboy, but like good, where you're sort of good, like you're dealing with sort of the weird side of suburbia, but as a Paperboy, it could be the new Gone Home. That's all.
I mean,
X-Files Paperboy.
I could actually see there being like an optional mode in a Grand Theft Auto game. You jump on a bike and hit R3, and all of a sudden the Paperboy mission mode starts up, and you are just like biking around throwing newspapers at people's homes, using the same mechanics that you would use for like holding an Uzi out the side of your car and shooting up the neighborhood.
Or it could be Rockboy.
I'm thinking the X-Files.
I don't know why I'm giving Rockstar ideas for free. They don't need it. They can give me money.
Escalate from like, you know, throwing the papers into the mailboxes to like throwing them into the mouths of the like Lovecraftian creatures coming out from behind the hedge.
Yeah,
like,
see, I'm thinking about Paperboy and Silent Hill.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Well, before we get crazy like that, why don't we...
One more idea.
All right.
Paperboy on a motorcycle.
There we go.
That's way too fast.
Well, now that we've taken it too far and ruined it,
Chris just died.
Let's take things back to the origins and talk to the creator of this game, John Solwitz. This is Jeremy Parrish, co-host of Retronauts. You're listening to another Retronauts episode at Game Developers Conference 2019. And this time I am here in the press room with... Sorry, how do you pronounce your last name?
Solwitz.
John Solwitz, who worked with Atari Games, and you're now with Electronic Arts.
I am. I am a principal technical director in the mobile part of EA.
Okay. But we're here to talk about old games, so I'd love to pick your brain about the experience of working on, you know, some of these Atari arcade classics in the mid-80s. You know, we've talked about Atari on the podcast before. You know, it's such a crucial part of video game history, but having the perspective of someone who was there and creating these games, these classics, is a rare opportunity. So thanks for taking the time to join the podcast.
Sure.
So yeah, just kind of going back, you know, Paperboy is kind of the thing you're here for, but I'm curious how you got involved in video games in the first place. What's the backstory there?
So I was I was always in the 70s. I went to high school in the 70s. A diehard arcade player. Although those days it was just much, you know, like in the side of a big store, they'd have games. So I was playing games like, I'm going all the way back, Lunar Lander, mm-hmm. Tank, or a couple that just jump out at me, and go down to the Jersey Shore and get to any arcade I could go to and play there. And I got a computer science degree from a very small liberal arts school in Pennsylvania. But during that whole time, kept playing games and actually writing games. I'd spend my evenings half in the theater, and then after that I'd leave and go to the lab and just write games. So I was always in love with it. Right out of college, I applied to Atari Games and received a rejection from Atari Games by postcard, no less. Just basically, thanks, but
public,
no thanks.
Right?
It wasn't a big conversation there. So I worked for a year for the Naval Ocean System Center as a programmer, reapplied because I was still playing games like crazy, and got an interview and got a job. So it's just always writing, always writing code, always writing games, a diehard player, and that fit right in.
Yeah, so what kind of computers were you working on at the time? Was
mostly
it a specific platform?
Timeshare. So, okay. Well, I go back to punch card, mm-hmm. and paper tape and stuff like that. IBM 1130, I think, way back there. And then there was Timeshare, which is this, you know, centralized computer, writing stuff in BASIC. And then in college, I guess I ended up starting work on VAX a lot. It's a PDP 11, basically. It's a lot of deck equipment, stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm just old enough to have caught the tail end of the VAX era.
Yeah, as well.
But I didn't do any programming. That's never been my, you know, something I've been any good at.
Paperways, in fact, built on the T11, Tiny 11, which is basically a PDP 11 on a chip.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
That's actually very interesting. So you said you applied to Atari Games. This was like post the sell-off from Warner. It was, you know, after the company split.
No, they were still. I started at Atari in '81.
Oh, okay.
No, we still worked for Warner. There was still the mm-hmm. Warner Company store and everything. Then we split off and basically got sold to Namco during the development of Paperboy.
Right.
I don't know. I don't remember the exact dates, but sure. Right about there. No, I was there, and when I got it, when I was hired, the day I was hired, I think I was hired in a room of about, you know, well over 100 people. We all had the orientation together. So it's just peak of Atari. Mm-hmm. They had just created a new manufacturing line that could crank out like 1,500 units a day. Give you some perspective.
Hardware or software?
Hardware. Whole games. Wow. Whole games.
Arcade machines.
Arcade machines.
That's a ton of arcade machines.
Particularly since by, you know, mid-'80s, if you could sell 3,000-5,000 units total, that was great news.
So you were always working in the arcade division.
Yeah, and I started at Atari Games Arcade and ended there.
Okay.
Well, before leaving for Electronic Arts, actually.
Okay, so I guess the like everything that happened, all the drama with the console market, didn't affect you as much as it did the people who were working in the console division. But I assume it was still, you know, it hit the company pretty hard.
It did. Don Traeger, who I talked to not too long ago, was our product marketing lead, described, you know, he'd have a marketing meeting on the coin-op side, and it was all pretty pumped up and positive and everything. But then when he went over to the consumer side, it was absolutely dreadful. Mm-hmm. But I was fairly insulated from this. As I just said in my talk, we had T-shirts back then that said Atari Games, Atari Coin Op, the real Atari. So we were pretty insulated and isolated, I suppose.
Yeah. So what games did you work on, before Paperboy?
First game I did for Atari was a game that was. Originally called Aka R, and then renamed Sentinel.
Okay.
It was originally a pinball video game, but then we couldn't figure out the pinball portion, so we went with a straight video game. And we worked on that for about, that was my first game at Atari, my first game with Dave Ralston, who was my partner, you know, at Atari. I was a programmer, he was designer, artist. So we worked on that for about 9 months, field tested it. It was crushed by Robotron, among other games. So that didn't last long. And that was it. That was my first.
Okay. Did Atari end up actually publishing any pinball video hybrids? I know like Bally Midway had a few, but
I don't recall Atari ever completing it. Atari did a handful of pinball games, as I remember, but not sure we ever did a hybrid.
Okay,
it's just difficult, really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean the ones that I, you know, like what was it, Baby Pac-Man was.
Yeah.
Like, it was not a great pinball game and not a great video game. And, you know, putting two kind of mediocre halves together did not make a great whole. So
Right.
It was an interesting idea, but yeah, I think just sticking to one strength or the other is probably the way to go. So, you know, beyond, you said it was Sentinel. What kind of projects did you have, or was it
was that Paperboy was it. Next? So Dave and I worked on Sentinel, and that did horribly in field tests, so it was sunset, it was killed. And then between that game, by the end of that game and the start of Paperboy was probably 3 or 4 months. That was it.
Okay. So you came on in 81 and Paperboy launched in 85?
The Paperboy was manufactured late 84. It was sold first in spring 1985.
Okay.
So I worked on Paperboy for about 2 years from, let me say, what about my math here, 82 to 84, somewhere around there.
That's an unusually long development cycle for a game in that era.
It was, although Atari leadership was open to that idea as long as you kept making progress and still willing to pretty much prioritize working on your game over every other activity in your life. That was fine. Paperboy, I think we developed for it was about 2 years, and I think 720, in fact, was about 18 months. So we were good at longer projects.
Okay, but it seems like they paid off. I mean, Paperboy was a huge hit.
It was. It sold... it sold well enough. It justified itself in the arcades by itself. Sold about 3,500 units. But its real win was, of course, when Mindscape ported it 3 years later to the NES, and it sold something on the order of 2 million units. At the end of the presentation I did today, we asked the audience which they had played, and it's probably 60-40 people who had played the NES version, actually, and had not really played the coin-op version that much. But the 40% had played coin-op.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely where I kind of got the experience of playing it first. And I feel like I kind of took the game for granted at the time because, you know, it had the handlebar controllers, which were so integral to the experience. But, you know, at the time, novel controllers were just, that's just kind of how things were. Like Spy Hunter had, you know, the steering wheel and a gas pedal. So you just kind of were like, oh, yeah, it's a weird control system.
Yeah, Atari games, the leadership of Atari actually pushed the teams to innovate in controllers. We had a full mechanical prototype shop. If you think about controllers at Atari, so Paperboy's controllers, ancestry comes from originally the Battlezone controller, which really became the Bradley controller. Atari did a short-lived game in conjunction with the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. That became kind of a tank controller. The tank controller became eventually the Star Wars controller in 83.
Oh, yeah.
And then the Star Wars controller is really kind of the stepdaddy of the Paperboy controller. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I guess I got so hung up on the aesthetics of it that I hadn't really stopped to think that it is essentially, you know, just kind of like the Star Wars controller evolved. But that does make sense. But, you know, I think also the difference in the game itself, like the sort of, is it isometric? Is it like
an isometric view?
Yeah.
The inspiration for that view came from Zaxxon. Mm-hmm. Although we kind of crushed the x-axis and made mm-hmm. it parallel to the bottom of the screen, largely because we wanted it to be parallel with the controller itself, because the whole thing felt a bit odd, pushing off angle. So yeah, it's an isometric, it's kind of 45 degree isometric perspective, which I'm sure has a better name that I simply do not remember. And that became the basis of our view, our look. Dave actually proposed the game at a brainstorming session, his original drawings of the game were in an isometric perspective. So I kind of always knew it was going to be that way.
Okay, interesting. So the another thing that really sets Paperboy apart, I think, is just the theme of it, which is so mundane compared to, you know, like at the same time you had games like Dragon's Lair and Space Ace and, you know, Dig Dug and Sinistar and stuff like these.
Yeah, Sinistar,
big
Dig
high
Dug
concept.
Before. Oh yeah, but the games, actually a lot of the games coming out in that era before when we started Paperboy were like a Robotron. Think of more mm-hmm. abstract. So moving towards raster based. Pretty intense, hardcore games, but abstract, you know, like they are now, a lot of shooting and stuff like that. Certainly nothing based on the career of a paper deliverer. Mm-hmm. It actually took me, Dave's idea won the Baharo Dunes brainstorming a session at Atari, but it took me a long time after that, at least probably a couple months, to come around the idea of working on a game based on a, you know, a paper delivery kid. I was into those hardcore games too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're right. It was, Dave did a drawing of a kid riding down the street, delivering newspapers and then, and avoiding characters. Dave Rolston is who I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So it made plenty of sense. Everybody liked it. It just took me a while to come around to it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's very unusual. Very, very much kind of the opposite of the fantasy sci-fi themes you saw in games of the era. But you know, when you started working on it, was that the concept from the beginning? Like as soon as you sat down and said, "Let's make this kind of isometric kind of shooter game," was it always going to be Paperboy, or
it was always
going to
be
along?
About a kid delivering newspapers?
Okay.
And this all came in layers. There was no grand. It was just, this game was built through iteration. So that is about delivering newspapers and avoiding characters and scrolling. So we knew that. So from that you get, well, you have customers. At the start when we started developing, everybody was a customer. So we start layering out of that. Oh, maybe some of the houses are not customers. And then you have a certain amount of interaction with those houses. Early on, it was that you were smashing the windows in those houses and trying not to smash the windows in your houses. But it was early themes were abstract. Our characters were very early on were quite weird, actually. We had things like pianos running down the street, and we had huge snails in the driveway instead of cars and stuff like that. Somewhat what you're talking about is that in that time, a lot of games were really abstract. Mm-hmm. You had Centipede and stuff like that, so that seemed almost natural to us.
Right, yeah, and then you had all the games coming over from Japan, which
right.
were just
Dig,
like
right.
anything
right.
goes.
Absolutely
yeah.
right. And so that we figured that held until we tested it in focus group, and that didn't hold. It didn't work. Players it didn't resonate with players. So we went with a more conventional character set at that point. Cast.
So that's interesting that the game actually became more grounded as you got player feedback.
It did. We had really good advice around us. I don't know if we figured it out ourselves or people around us. were able to influence us towards, you know, kind of that better direction. But mm-hmm. we got it eventually, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you mentioned that one of the early concepts was avoidance. Was the idea of having the, you know, the paper projectiles there from the start, or was it more like a Pac-Man kind of thing where you're really just trying to dodge monsters or enemies and
like not always had delivery early on, and always had the concept of driving the kid with a bicycle handlebars. So that mechanic was there. It was first and foremost about delivering newspapers. Mm-hmm. So we did that. That was early. And then also early would have been avoiding characters and not running into the sides of houses and stuff like that. Right. So the maze concept, those things held early on. But then as things started to get layered onto that, as the characters got more interesting and they became more aggressive towards the kid, traffic in the street, jump ramps, this kind of layering, that's what really happened. And that, again, had through iteration and brainstorming largely.
Mm-hmm.
So those mechanics were there, but they got added piece by piece.
Other things that makes Paperboy, I think, very unusual among games is that, you know, it is kind of a shooter and that you have the projectiles that you're throwing, but you're not shooting on the same axis that you're moving. You're actually throwing perpendicular to your movement, which, you know, and there's even kind of like a sort of a forward physics on that where they're not going directly perpendicular to your character. They're actually, they have some velocity to them, so you have to kind of master that mechanic. Was that something like, I'm curious about the creative process there and the trial and error you had to go through.
So I would think of the throwing, we thought of the throwing of papers and the movement in the game more akin to pinball than a shooter. I think it's got a lot, Dave Ralston, my partner in this thing, had his roots in pinball design.
Okay.
Started Atari about a year before I did and worked on pinball and was a diehard pinball player. And so if you look at some of the Paperboy mechanics, I think that there's some of their history is going to come from pinball as much as anything. I don't think we thought it was a shooter. Neither Dave and I really wanted to work on shooters at all. We really didn't want to work on violent games. The first game I ever worked on that actually had any kind of weapon in it was Rampart, and it's kind of an abstract castle knocking over thing. That really wouldn't have been what we were thinking of. It'd be more about the mechanics of pinball and motion. I have a physics minor, so I have always, as a game programmer, I have always used a lot of physics. I've always liked motion a lot. Love that kind of kinetics and stuff like that around that. So there is certain that when I was writing that, I would have had the velocity of the bike be part of the velocity of the paper as it came out of his hand. That's just interesting. Otherwise, it would look terrible anyway. But the and yes, you're absolutely right. What's so amazing about human beings is that we can do that in our brains. Throw an object perpendicular to your view, have it move parallel with your view, and aim it. That's still amazing to me. That was a great mechanic because of that.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that, you know, it's like the first time you play, your shots don't go where you think they're going to. And then you kind of quickly realize, the papers are tracking the motion that my paperboy is tracking. So you quickly adapt. And it's just that I think kind of that magic threshold of skill and mastery without being too complex. Like, it's a very intuitive concept, but it takes practice.
Yeah, and Paperboy is a bit of a plate spinning game too, because while you're mastering that, you are avoiding other characters in the street. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of formulating a strategy as to where, how far away from the house is. That same mechanic that you're talking about changes radically if you are in the street versus if you're close to the house. When you're close to the house, it's much more of a straight line throw. But by the time you get to the street, if you can even get the paper there at all, it has moved substantially as you've, you know, translated up the playfield.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, looking for bundles, managing, you know, which place to throw to or not and all the rest. So it's a lot to, it's a hard game.
Right. Well, you know, I think part of that is because your character actually occupies so little of the screen. You know, you've basically got the little corner and you don't have a lot of room to maneuver. You don't have a lot of time to react.
Right.
So that makes it very challenging. But at the same time, you can't memorize it because there's that element of randomness. You never know kind of how the neighborhood is going to unfold each time.
Yeah, it's actually, well, the original game is very much a pattern game. What makes it feel more random is that the neighborhood reacts to your previous day. So it's in the original, there were very few random values. I think it's probably some. I'm sure there was some, but the, you know, it was like, you know, so as basic as if you lost a house, the owner of that house would become an obstacle in the next round. So that kind of perturbated it, changed it a bit. If you and where you ride on the street triggers different characters, so you don't always see them. And then there is kind of a day-to-day clock on top of that whole thing that does give it more of a feel of randomness. But the original game was heavily scripted.
Okay, it's been a long time since I played the arcade Paperboy. I've played some of the home ports pretty recently, actually, and kind of studied them, but I thought the houses that you have to hit each day, you know, isn't that randomized from game to game?
Not at all.
Well, that's my mistake then.
In the original, at least, there are 10, you know, you have 20 houses on two blocks. 10 of those are your customers. 10 of those are not.
Okay.
If you lose one, if you don't deliver to it, of course, then it becomes the other, and then you can get it back again. But no, it's well fixed. And partly because a lot of the houses were designed to be non-customer houses. You can never get them back.
Mm-hmm.
You can never earn them. And they're designed to, Dave's designs, they don't even have porches, pretty much. It's just all windows. It is an absolute, this goes to your metaphor, right? It is a shooting gallery at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe come back to the whole throwing thing. The customers is a lot more pinball-esque, because you're trying to put a paper on a very specific place and not hit it anywhere else. That's kind of equivalent to, you know, shooting a pinball through a specific drop target.
Mm-hmm.
But the windows on a non-customer are a lot more kind of shooting gallery-esque.
Right,
I mean, you really can't go wrong. Just go nuts.
Right. Yeah, I referred to it as, you know, kind of being like a shooting game just because, you know, as you say, it comes from Zaxxon. And you are like a moving object in a scrolling field, and you're throwing projectiles. But I do think, you know, the nonviolence of it is a big part of the game's appeal. It's, you know, even 35 years ago, we had, you know, the fact that it was a nonviolent game made it kind of novel.
Yeah,
you didn't have a lot of other games that kind of, you know, took that approach.
Yeah, I mean. The basic relationship between characters and their world around them has been mostly the same for most games. It's an incredibly great mechanic. It works. I don't think I'm saying anything revolutionary there. I think we've all figured it out. I'm always blown away, not just Paperboy, but any games where they really, really work hard to get away from that. If you look at the indie games these days, a lot of times they're trying to get away from that,
mm-hmm.
and that's not easy.
It's
not familiar. We are accustomed, we are trained to have a relationship with our world in video games, and so being able to twist that a bit, if you're successful, pays off enormously. Like say The Sims, and so it was worth doing.
So what do you think it was about the NES version that made it such a huge breakout hit?
It was I think the that it was on the NES doesn't hurt, that the size of the audience didn't hurt.
Sure, but I mean there were lots of NES games that did not sell 2 million copies.
I think in all modesty, I think that the Paperboy rule set and world and fiction worked. And I think we laid a very good groundwork for that. It was they did a heck of a good job in a port, Mindscape did. I read somewhere, by the way, that it was the first whole game made in the United States for Nintendo. I'd have to check that fact, but I believe it was so.
It was definitely one of the first, if not the first,
So they did they did a good job porting it. The fiction and storyline and mechanic were held. And I think, actually, this is interesting. So Atari eventually added Tengen to do their ports. And at the time, part of the theory was, and this is a few years later, that we would use the arcades to introduce the game. This is a great way to sell games. I mean, think about it. It's a great way to sell games at 25 cents, 50 cents, whatever. Get people familiar with the brand. And then if you bring a true derivative to the home, that's pretty cool. And that's the job I wanted to do forever, because the hardwares at Atari were awesome. Custom hardware is built for your game that were orders of magnitude more powerful than any other game hardware.
Right.
How cool is that?
With custom interfaces.
Custom interfaces, custom controls, everything. It is very much equivalent to working in film and having them do, sitcoms based on your work. And so if you had good fiction, if you had good gameplay and all that, it would translate. And that held for a while. But Paperboy particularly it held for, I think, again, largely because they did a really good job in the port, but it was also a game, it's a hard game that people had really, really wanted to play. It did very well in the arcades, and so it was a great marketing vehicle too, I suppose.
Find that people, younger people these days, get Paperboy, like that occupation, the idea of delivering papers as a summer job,
probably
that doesn't
not.
Exist anymore.
There are a bunch of spoof videos on Paperboy. I used a couple of them in my presentation today. The one, which is kind of really not that nice, but still it's still pretty funny, is that a bunch of people went out at like 4:30 in the morning and got in the way of this guy. He's in his pickup truck. He is the actual paper delivery person. He throws papers out of his truck and stood and played all the Paperboy characters. So no, not really. Interesting enough, Paperboy did well in Europe. And there was very little notion ever of a paperboy in Europe. I was a paperboy. Dave was a lot more of a paperboy than I was. So, no, I don't think so. They barely understand what a print newspaper is. I the game still gets played. I still regularly hear stories of, these days, mostly it's like people playing the paperboy with their kid.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I don't think they quite understand. What are you doing on a bicycle delivering newspapers?
Were you involved with any of the Paperboy sequels or spinoffs?
I was not. Dave was somewhat. In fact, I barely knew that they were doing a Nintendo port. I probably was told, but Atari, Atari did not do sequels. There's a couple of things. We've touched on one of them. They pushed the teams to differentiate games based on controller, largely because you notice the controller when you walk up to a game. And they also pushed teams to innovate in game design. Which was made it a pretty cool job. I mean, because most developers, they given the opportunity, like, oh, let's go do a whole new game. And we did. And in time span of 10 years, I did 5 original titles, one that got killed as the lead, and worked on a couple others as a help during the time I was there. So after Paperboy came out, after a few months break, we tore into 720, and after 720, we tore into Cyberbowl, and after Cyberbowl, we tore into Rampart. And so I barely knew of the other development, and frankly, I was not disinterested, but I was much more excited about building these whole new games.
Sure, yeah.
That was pretty cool.
I mean, when I think of Atari games from the mid-80s, it's just like hit after hit, you know, like classics like Marble Madness, Gauntlet, Rampart, Paperboy, et cetera. It's, you know, that I think that that commitment to originality really paid off. And there,
it did.
For a while, you know, there was just, you saw an Atari game in the arcades, and you were like, this is different. Like, here's a game where I can team up with three of my friends and just go, you know, fight ghosts and stuff in a maze. Or
yeah, and those games were all made in spitting distance of each other. Mm-hmm. The Gauntlet Lab was catty corner to the Paperboy Lab. Bob Flanagan, who was on the Paperboy originally, ended up working on Paperboy and Marble Madness and Gauntlet. So there's Ed Logg and Bob working on Gauntlet, Mark Cerny working on Marble Madness. He was right next to me. Dave Toyer was working on APB. Ed Rotberg was, you know, working on Shoes. I mean, just all these games. Heath Lipson, it's, you know, working on RBI. These games were all right next to each other, and we were all pretty close friends too. It wasn't adversarial. It was competitive for sure. So you could just walk from your lab into the adjacent lab and play a completely different game. Game team sizes ranged from, well, in the 80s, probably got as big as 8 people on a team, as much as that. Mm-hmm. And several of those 2 people would probably be on a couple different games. But, you know, so you worked it by yourself in a lab working on your game. That's where the hardware was. That was where the one version of that game was. You wandered into other people's labs to play their games at lunches. And that's what you did.
So, just to kind of, you know, wind this down, I'd love to talk a little bit about Rampart, too. Because when I look back, I feel like that was my first introduction to strategy gaming or something akin to strategy. What was the kernel of inspiration for that one?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think I probably had, well, Dave and I partnered very much on that. I was big into strategy and strategy style games. We came up with the mechanic of building, using Tetris style pieces to surround a thing. And that was cool. And we worked that out. I was not into straight puzzle games. And we had just, well, that's right, of course, we had just finished a bunch of, you know, both Cyberball 1 and Cyberball 2072, so I was really into competitive games too, and playing a ton of competitive games. And so turning that into a competitive game probably would have been my best first instinct. Certainly Dave and I were both competitive, but particularly I was. And so it was natural to go from that to that. I have to remember now how we came up with the various aspects of doing the perspective change and all that. That was the first time I worked on true bitmap, so we could. I think Dave probably pushed for that. The top-down drawing was just not that. Oh, yeah, I mean, that was it. We were trying to contrast the difference between a puzzle look and a battle look, and so we did that. Yeah, Rampart was a blast to work on. I loved it, and we played the heck out of that. We would always have multiple people in our lab playing the heck out of that game daily. It was pretty fiercely competitive at Atari.
So I'm trying to remember. It's been a long time since I've played Rampart, you know, the arcade version, but that was a trackball game, right?
Originally trackball. Yeah. We were thoroughly convinced that it could never be a joystick until we put a joystick on it. And we're like, oh, works great on joystick. It's actually kind of easier. Rampart, the Rampart sequels, Franz Lenziger ended up doing a really good sequel of Rampart, but a lot of the sequels are really horrible because the controller gets wrong. If you don't nail the controller in that game, there is no game. Mm-hmm. It's just bad. And so the trackball was really natural. But as a cost cutting, I think we did a 3-person trackball version, and then Atari wanted to do a 2-person, and we tried joystick, which I think I was kind of pushing against until we did it. And I went like, oh my God, this works really well. And so we went that way after that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. So, you know, what kind of projects have you worked on beyond Atari?
After leaving Atari, Dave and I went to work at Electronic Arts together.
Mm-hmm.
We did a game called Hunting, starring Poltergeist, okay. which is kind of a, it's a sim game, really. It's about, you play the role of a ghost trying to scare everybody out of a house. It was on the Genesis. EA had a short-lived coin-op. We actually went there to start their coin-op division. It took me a very long time to realize that the arcades were dying. Mm. I mean, a really long time. Because I had a lot of success there, so it was hard for me to give that up.
Right.
But the coin-op division got closed, so we started our own company, amazingly, in arcades, and trying to do arcade games in the mid-90s. I mean, PS1 had just come out, and we still wanted to do arcade games. And we did a few things there. We did a game called Vapor TRX, which is kind of this flying racing game. And my group did Running Wild. And then we did a version of a pretty cool baseball game. We've been a diehard baseball fan, so is Dave, called World Series Baseball.
Okay.
Did that. And then eventually I left Blue Shift, and I've been at EA since, working on much larger titles.
Mm-hmm.
Not creatively. I got pushed into management at some point, and then...
Happens to the best of
it
us.
It is, really. And then now I'm a technical director working with multiple teams.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I really appreciate you coming in and kind of sharing your anecdotes about Paperboy and Rampart. If people want to find you online and follow your work, where should they look?
It's a great question. LinkedIn.
Okay.
I do a pretty horrible job of having much of an online presence.
Mm-hmm.
LinkedIn's a good place to find me if you want to get a hold of me. Then otherwise, you kind of look at the credits at EA, and I suppose you can find me there too.
Okay. Well, John, thank you for your time.
Of course. Thank you so much.